This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Much, if not all, of the focus in Washington, D.C. right now is on our relationship with Russia and the nature of the information President Trump shared with leading Russian diplomats. But there's a lot of other business in the works, not the least of which is the bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
The House passed its legislation last month, a bill called the American Health Care Act. It faces what most analysts say is a very uncertain future in the Senate. That body has not yet formally begun debate on ACHA. Barbara Zabawa is our regular health policy contributor. She heads the Wisconsin-based Center for Wellness Law and teaches at UWM's College of Health Sciences. She also has a brand new book out on the laws of workplace wellness programs. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, Barbara Zabawa, it is always nice to see you.
Very nice to see you, Mitch. Thanks for having me again.
Let's start with the health care debate in Washington. The Senate is still, I believe, waiting for numbers from the Congressional Budget Office before it will take up the House bill that's being labeled as Trump care now in the media. Republicans who backed the bill in the House say it should satisfy concerns about its ability to offer coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. What is your read on, knowing again that full numbers aren't out, what's your read at this point on how this bill addresses that issue?
Well, my understanding is that it would separate those with pre-existing conditions into separate pools. States would be encouraged to provide high-risk pools. Wisconsin had a high-risk pool before the Affordable Care Act. It was HRSP. And it basically pools all of those people who can't otherwise get insurance because they have conditions into the same pool, then they get coverage through those high-risk pools. And that enables those who don't have pre-existing conditions, namely people who are younger and healthier, to get insurance in a more affordable fashion because they aren't subsidizing essentially those with the pre-existing condition. So they can get coverage that meets their needs, which may not be as extensive as those who have pre-existing conditions.
At the same time, there are sort of fewer mandates involved in this version than what was seen under the Affordable Care Act.
Right. So the 10 essential benefits that plans right now under the Affordable Care Act must cover if they are offered through the individual market and the small group market wouldn't be there. Plans would have more flexibility as to what benefits they could cover. And so, of course, there's been a lot of back and forth about whether people who don't need maternity benefits, for example, should be paying for maternity benefits.
Well, and that's a philosophical discussion to be had. And one of the points you have made on this show before is that we're having these philosophical questions, but there's one big question that really nobody is talking about through much of this.
Yeah, well, and that is the cost of healthcare. I mean, the cost of healthcare really is still climbing. Now, Warren Buffett met with his group last week. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal where he was quoted as saying, you know, it's not tax reform isn't going to help American business move forward. We need to get a handle on the high cost of health care. Employers do, because that's what's holding them back. And it has grown now to over 17% of our gross domestic product. And so it's unsustainable in a lot of ways. However, we do have a lot of stakeholders who benefit from that large piece of the pie of our GDP. And that's what makes it so complicated in really enacting reform that's going to get at those high costs.
And so the ultimate issue is that nobody is willing to stick their neck out and say, hey, you should be the group that gets less money here.
Right. I mean, whenever you have something as complicated as healthcare, you're going to have winners and losers. And rather than talking about what's best for the greater good, we're still stuck in what's best for this group or that group. And that really is what makes things difficult to move forward.
You know, turning back for a moment to the high-risk pool idea, you know, the Speaker of the House of Wisconsin, Congressman Paul Ryan, just in the last day or so, pointed to Wisconsin's high-risk pool as a success story. Can you walk us through whether that comparison is appropriate?
Yeah, well, I guess it really depends on who you ask. I mean, I know I've experienced people who were part of that high-risk pool or tried to get into that high-risk pool, and there was a waiting list. And so the people who were on that high-risk pool did have to pay quite a bit of money for coverage. But at the same time, they did have coverage. It did provide somewhat of a safety net. So it really depends on your perspective as to the success of that program. Just like it depends on your perspective of whether the Affordable Care Act has been beneficial for you or not. It depends on if you perhaps were part of that high-risk pool and now your coverage costs may have gone down and you have more coverage versus you were only interested in getting catastrophic coverage and now you can't because you have to pay for all these other benefits that you don't want or need. And so it harkens back to that other fundamental question that you and I have talked about is healthcare something that every American should have as an entitlement, as a right, or is it a privilege? And as a country, we're still divided on that question.
And so you are not a political analyst, but as someone who pays close attention to this world, what would you expect would come out of this debate when it does turn to the Senate?
I think ultimately there will be some fixes to the Affordable Care Act that will be labeled Trump Care because there does need to be improvements. I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but I think that there's room for improvement and that the Senate will, I hope, hear from constituents, from stakeholders in the industry. I certainly understand that there are many healthcare stakeholders, providers, and insurers who are trying to get in front of the Senate to describe what they believe needs to be done to improve the bill. And I'm hopeful that that's what will happen in the end.
So let's turn now for a minute to some pretty good news on your front. You have a brand new book out.
Yes.
It is called Rule the Rules of Workplace Wellness Programs. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was 2 years in the making.
And it's obviously a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So for our listeners, unless they are pursuing this particular course of study, they may not be likely to go out looking for the book. But in general terms, you start the book by pointing out there has been a pretty vast hole in the information that's out there in this field. So what can you tell us in layman's terms about what has been lacking?
So workplace wellness programs, maybe a lot of your listeners are work for companies that have wellness programs in their company.
I just got an email from one like 5 minutes before he came into the studio.
Oh, well, there you go. They're pretty pervasive, pretty popular. But there's a lot of laws that are impacted with workplace wellness programs. You know, a lot of these programs collect data. And that's one of the reasons why some employees are hesitant to participate. They don't want to give up their data to their employer, and they're not sure what's going to happen to it.
Like this is telling their employer how much they weigh or whether
Correct.
They've been a smoker or anything, lifestyle
right.
choices.
That's right. And so there are laws in place that offer protections for privacy, provide some guidance on how you handle data that's collected. And it's more than just data. I mean, it's also abilities to participate in, you know, exercise programs or diet programs. So my book really goes through all those laws, mostly federal laws, that impact workplace wellness programs so that those people who are designing and implementing them in the workplace have an understanding of the legal parameters of the workplace wellness program.
So as you say, these are fairly popular in the workplace. So their numbers have gone up, their use has gone up. How new are the laws regarding these programs? And so how difficult was it for you to wrap your brain around being able to, you know, basically guide people through them?
Well, some of the laws are very old, actually, and it's just applying them to a new area, workplace wellness. Things like the Fair Labor Standards Act or workers' compensation, you know, they've been around for a very long time, but there hasn't been a lot of thought given to how those laws might apply to workplace wellness. Not a whole lot written about it either, and so my book goes into that. But some of the laws are new, like two of the main laws that are just discussed, I believe, in Chapter 4 are Genetic Information, Non-Discrimination Act, and Americans with Disabilities Act. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that enforces those parts of those laws, came out with rules just a year ago that impact workplace wellness programs. And so those rules are also discussed. So it really is a variety of how long some of these rules have been in existence and applying those rules specifically to workplace wellness program.
Of course, the legal climate has changed, or the regulatory climate has changed a fair amount in Washington in the last few months and over the last few years. Is being able to write a book on this a little like nailing Jell-O to the wall?
Yes. Yes. I do find myself in a unique position, sort of a selfish position, hoping that the laws don't change dramatically between now and, oh, say, a couple years, because I'd like to take a break before I have to, you know, update my book.
It'll be horrible to have volume two of this come out in November.
Yes, exactly. After having spent 2 years writing the first edition.
Well, if there has been this vast hole in this knowledge out there or in this area of study, how did you get to be an expert in it?
I've been interested in workplace wellness. It was something I had actually studied in Europe before I even went to graduate school. I didn't study it from the legal angle. I just thought it was interesting what the role employers play in helping employees lead healthier lives or wanting to help employees lead healthier lives. And so that's always been in the back of my mind. And then when I started my own law firm about 3 years ago, I went to a couple of conferences on wellness and quickly realized that they weren't talking about compliance issues, even though there were a couple of three lawsuits that were brought by the EEOC against companies, two companies in Wisconsin. And so it was top of mind for a lot of companies about, well, can we do this or should we do this? Are we going to get into legal trouble if we do this? And so I decided to start writing a book about it because I couldn't personally find a whole lot of resources out there. And so I thought there needs to be a resource. And so far, the feedback I've gotten is that it's a welcome resource. And as you pointed out, it isn't something you want to pick up and read at the beach. But
that's a pretty cover.
if you are at all involved with workplace wellness program design, so you might be an HR professional or an insurance broker or a health promotion specialist or an athletic trainer or a dietitian, this book might be of interest to you.
You mentioned the time you spent studying workplace wellness programs in Europe. Where were you in Europe?
I was in England, Sweden, and the Netherlands.
Well, and so in general terms, can you kind of tell us how workplace wellness is treated in those places versus, you know, compare and contrast how we approach it here?
A little bit. I mean, their laws are different. I know when I was in England, I was looking at programs that were specific to employees on the plant floor. I went to several manufacturing companies, and they had programs that were separate from they separated the people who worked in the plant versus the people who worked in the corporate. And then in Sweden, there was a lot more emphasis on organizational development, looking at the organization and the environment, the working environment. And they had laws that were very supportive of work-life balance. You know, they had an excellent family leave law even back then. You got a year of paid leave. and then in the Netherlands, it changed a little bit for me, my project. So I focused less on workplace wellness and more on public health type of things. But, you know, the laws really do, and I think my book tries to get at this point, really do shape how you approach workplace wellness. And you can use the law to design a better program, or you can be afraid of it and not use it appropriately and then perhaps find yourself in trouble.
I wonder, not to give you more work to do, I wonder whether there's a companion volume that's targeted at employees in this paradigm.
It's an interesting question. I mean, certainly Chapter 9, which is the data privacy chapter of my book, is something that I think employees would find of interest because again, one of the reasons why employees are hesitant to participate is because of their fear of what's going to happen to my information that I give you through my health risk assessment or my biometric screen. And Chapter 9 tries to dig into that a little bit. What does that look like out there when you start putting your information out into the, you know, internet, the web? Who's getting it? What are they doing with it? And do I want to be part of that? It's quite an eye-opener, frankly. It was for me.
I feel like that is a topic for maybe our next interview down the road.
Yeah, could be.
Sounds great. Again, congratulations. And Barbara Zabawa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Barbara Zabawa heads the Center for Wellness Law. She's also a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and co-author of the new book, Rule the Rules of Workplace Wellness Programs. She's also a regular Lake Effect contributor, and you can find more of our conversations archived at WUWM.com.
You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com.